Well, that was a great sermon today, wasn't it? Man, it really was. And, you know, listening to Chloe come in and talk, it just reminded me of the fact, kind of going along with the pastor's sermon, that God's purposes move forward. I mean, I told her when I saw her a minute ago that I remember when she was about this little, because we went to church together with her parents, Byron and her mom, and she was just a cute little girl. And now she's all grown up, and the Lord is working through her in a great way in the Middle Eastern area of the world. And remember to pray for her, because it is a dangerous place for Christians wherever she is at. So looking forward to seeing what the Lord will do. We are in the Song of Solomon this week. Somebody before class mentioned, how did you draw the short stick for the Song of Solomon? they didn't actually say that, but some people think it's hard to teach from it, and parts of it are probably. I've been in the business I've been in for about 43 years as of last week. And I've met a lot of people in the business I'm in. I've met a lot of buyers, a lot of people that buy steel, stainless steel pipe and fittings and things like that. Well, one guy in particular, I'll call him Paul because I don't want to reveal who he is. We'll just call him Paul because I don't know anybody in my business really called Paul. But this man, I've known him probably for 25 years. Paul buys pipe from me, but he's also a golfer. He loves to golf. And Paul's probably, I know he's been golfing for the 25 years that I've known him at least. And he just doesn't golf once a week. He's a bachelor. He goes out and plays three or four times a week in the summertime. And in the wintertime, he gets out maybe one or two times depending on the weather. But here's the thing about Paul. Paul has never gotten any better at golf. Not at all. I've known him for over 25 years. And Paul is just the same as he was 25 years ago. He told me last year he broke 90 for the first time. Now this, I don't know if you know anything about golf, but if you play three or four times a week, you should be able to break 90 consistently. And so I suggested to him one time, I said, you know, Paul, why don't you try and take a lesson? Just see what it's, in a nice way. I didn't say it like that. And he never did. And he never got any better. I've played golf for over 50 years, and I can tell you that I know if he would take lessons and apply them, he would be breaking 90 a lot consistently. You know, I thought about that in preparation for this lesson this week, because there's a lot of things in life, really, that we would probably all get better at if we took some lessons, if we took instructions. Let me ask you, what are some things you believe people generally want to get better at doing in life? What are some things people like to want to really get better at?
Walking.
Understand.
So if they have a talent, they want to take lessons and perfect their talent.
Sure. If you got a little talent in something, you want to get better at it. Right. Use it. What do they want to get better at? Walking. If you have a talent.
Gardening.
Yeah. Definitely.
Knowledge of.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's a good point. Something brand new. You want to get better at that.
To be obedient to the Lord.
Obedient to the Lord. You're the spiritual one in here.
Oh, right.
Well, all right. Well, you know, we could probably think of a lot of things if we stopped and thought about it for a moment, but I think we'd all agree that in most of those cases, if we had just a little bit of instruction in certain areas, we'd probably do better at it. Here's the thing. There's something that all of us engage in day after day that I am sure we would all agree that if we were to have some lessons or some instruction, we want to get better at it too. And I'm talking about our relationships. And that's what we're going to be talking about today, our relationships, those one-on-one relationships that we have throughout our days with multiple people. And you know, there's all kinds of relationships, right? But the most intimate, of course, and designed to be the most satisfying relationship by God is, of course, the marriage relationship. Now, we're just, as I mentioned, just touching briefly, really, in the Song of Solomon this week and next week, and then we're going on to Isaiah, I believe. But The book of the Song of Solomon is entitled in my Bible. Some of your Bibles might call it the Song of Songs or the Psalm of Psalms. In fact, the book actually opens up in chapter 1, verse 1 with these words, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. And Solomon wrote this book just as he wrote most of, or actually did write, Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. And now we have the Song of Solomon. And he says, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. Now, let me ask you a question. Why did King Solomon call this the Song of Songs? What is meant by this title? What does it mean when it says the Song of Songs? What do you think that means? Oh, I'm not gonna. I'm just gonna sit here until, let's see, we can be here a long time. Now, the Song of Song. What?
It's the best of the
That's it, exactly right. And I have a little thing in this little Bible I use for teaching, and at the bottom it's got a little note on here, and it says, the best of the songs. It's the best of the best, right? Just like at one time Arnold Palmer was the best golfer in the world, and then Jack Nicklaus, and maybe Gary Player, and then Tiger Woods, and then last year is Brooks Koepka. This year it's who is the best golfer? John Rahm, right? Yeah, John Rahm. It's the best of the best is what we're talking about here. And I think we mentioned this the other day. I remember when Joe was teaching the other day, he mentioned the fact that Solomon actually wrote, and it says this in the Bible in 1 Kings, he wrote 1,005 songs. 1,005 songs. And out of all those songs, this one, Solomon considered his best. And so we should take notice. There's a lot in this book. Now, what's this book all about? Well, the book really is Solomon's what I call a poetic autobiography. A poetic, and it is a poetic, it's sort of like a poem or a song, but it's really an autobiography in which he chronicles this romantic love story between himself and this Shulamite woman. And throughout the book, he takes this all the way through from the dating stage before they got married into their betrothal stage, their marriage ceremony, and on into later years of marriage. But the significant thing about this book is it's really interlaced throughout the pages with all kinds of really rich insights into God's wisdom for relationships, for love, for romance, and in marriage, of course. Well, our lesson this week takes place during the very early years of their relationship. And so you might sit back now and you say, oh, the early years. Well, I've been married for, I don't know, 40, 50, 60 years or whatever, 30-some years, whatever, or 10 years, whatever. And you think, well, this doesn't really apply to me. I'm not going to begin a relationship. I mean, if we're going to start where Solomon, before he even knew this much about this lady, and he's starting a relationship, that doesn't really apply to me. Or you might say to yourself, well, I'm not going to get married. I don't intend to do that. This doesn't really apply to me. Or you might say, and some of this can be applied to just friendships. You might say, I've been friends with them for years. None of this is going to apply to me. But just wait a minute, because the title of our lesson this week is Relational Foundations. Relational Foundations. You see, this couple was trying to start out right. They were trying to start out right. You know, many of us may have not even thought about building a strong foundation for our relationship when we were starting out, you know, as before we, maybe when we were dating or before we got married. Some couples may still, when you think about it, it's possible to have a weak foundation in your marriage even now, despite the fact that you've been married for years and years and years. Things could be so much better possibly. So, let's not be like my friend Paul, you know, flailing away at the golf ball and never taking a lesson. Because what we have right here in front of us, in our passages, in the book of Song of Songs, Song of Solomon, is some of God's wisdom for the marriage relationship. And as I mentioned, it extends into other relationships. You can make applications as well. I was in real estate for several years, just selling part-time, so I had to give it up because I got too busy. But I know, and probably you know from living in Oklahoma long enough, that foundations are a problem in a lot of houses, especially even in the Tulsa area. And a lot of times I'd list a house or take somebody to a house and it had foundation repairs. Not necessarily a bad thing. A lot of people thought it was, but here's the thing about that. Once you pier that foundation, once you either jack it up or sink down concrete to the bedrock, That foundation is firm. It's even better once it's paired. It's not going to go anywhere, most likely. And that's the same way, really, in our marriages. Once a marriage is paired, once it has that strong foundation, that marriage is stronger than it was before. So it's never too late to strengthen the foundation of your marriage. I'm going to look at these as sort of like building blocks. So let's look at the first building block for a solid foundation, a solid relational foundation. And in our lesson, the first point was preventative care, preventative care. Now, it's good to always begin with some context, right? So the context in our story, the real setting for our lesson really starts out in chapter 2, verse 8, if you want to turn over to chapter 2, verse 8. And it begins in the springtime of the year. How many people like springtime? You don't like storms. My wife doesn't like storms. She likes springtime except for the storms. And all the yard work starts up again, and your allergies probably along with it, right? But this setting in our lesson begins in the springtime of the year. And Israel is, we've been there a couple times in the spring, and it is beautiful in Israel in the springtime. There's little wildflowers that grow up, and there's a fragrance from some of the flowers at that time of the year. And in the early mornings, it's very cool and very nice. But it describes really here a romantic scene. And as they stroll together throughout the Israeli countryside, they're just talking about their relationship and thinking about their relationship. It begins in chapter 2, verse 8. I'll just start reading here. And this is actually the woman talking. All throughout this book, you'll find out either it's her, the Shulamite woman, or Solomon, or it could be who they call the daughters of Jerusalem, or the young ladies, the young maids, speak throughout here. And there's some young men that kind of talk. But you always have to really, as you read this book, think about who's speaking. Well, in this case, we're starting out here, and this is the Shulamite woman speaking, and she says, "Listen, my beloved, behold, he is coming, climbing on the mountains, leaping on the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, he is standing behind our wall. He is looking through the windows. He is peering through the lattice." And then she's going to quote him. She's going to quote Solomon. "My beloved," that's Solomon, "responded and said to me, 'Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along. For behold, the winter is past. The rain is over and gone. The flowers have already appeared in the land.'" As I was telling you, the little flowers in Israel are very beautiful. "The time has arrived for pruning the vines, and the voice of the turtle dove has been heard in our land. The fig tree has ripened its figs, and the vines in blossom have given forth their fragrance." And as I mentioned, there's fragrance from some of these plants if you ever get to go there in the springtime. "Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along." And then, my dove, in the clefts of the rock, in the secret place of the steep pathway, let them see your form. This is getting pretty romantic here. "Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your form is lovely." All right, so stop right there. You know, you can kind of get an idea of what's going on here. It's a romantic scene. And here's this scene. It's just kind of a happy romantic love. And then we read in verse 15 this: "Catch the foxes for us, the little foxes that are ruining the vineyards, while our vineyards are in blossom." What? What's this? You know, tilt, screech. It seems like this is a random comment to me when I read it the first time. Seems like it's sort of out of place with this couple's romantic experience. Doesn't it seem to you that way, that it's kind of unlikely that somebody in the middle of a romantic experience like this would suddenly notice some foxes over here in the field, you know, eating some crops or harming some crops? Or if you did, you probably would kind of file it in the back of your memory for dealing with it later. Let's say, for example, you and your wife are at home, and you're sort of in a romantic mood, and you're talking about your relationship and everything and so on, and it's just a nice time, and all of a sudden you look out in the backyard and there's these gophers actually coming out of the holes, and they're starting to dig holes in your yard. If you're in a romantic mood, you're probably not going to say, "Oh, look over here. Look at these gophers out in our backyard. What are we going to do about that?" Well, why then? The reason I bring... What's that?
I said I wouldn't.
You would. Yeah, we could go somewhere with that story, I'm sure. But the reason I bring this up is to ask my question. I had to ask myself the question, why then did she or whoever said verse 15, we're not sure in this case, why did he or she mention these little destructive foxes? And furthermore, even beyond that, why did Solomon record it? Any ideas? So I can take a drink of water while you're thinking about it. Why? Why did he record this little verse? Hey, that's great. You're right on the money. Exactly. I think that's exactly it. Here's the thing. She or he, whoever spoke verse 15, really isn't talking about foxes. Little foxes. And Solomon knew that, and that's why Solomon recorded this verse. You know, let's use our sanctified imagination that our pastor always talks about. I mean, they're out walking along, romantically inclined, and they spy these little foxes off in the fields, eating their crops, and what happens, I believe, it spurs one of their minds toward their upcoming marriage. And one of them sees this little scene with the foxes as sort of a reminder that their relationship actually could be threatened by some sort of destructive creatures as well. And so one of them says this, "Catch the foxes for us, the little foxes that are ruining the vineyards, while our vineyards are in blossom." And I believe what he or she is really talking about here was that their upcoming marriage and really their need to protect their relationship from harmful forces. You know, foxes are cute, actually. Pretty cute. We've been watching on YouTube this lady that has all kinds of foxes. She kind of, I guess she rescues them maybe. But there's one called Finnegan Fox, and he's really cute. If you ever get to, just Google him, and he's Finnegan Fox is cute to watch. You know, and you've been to zoos. We've been to zoos. We've seen them in zoos. We've even have them in our neighborhood from time to time. But, you know, as we all know, they are destructive, right? The foxes are destructive. They what?
They eat the swan's eggs.
Yes. Okay. Swan's eggs? Okay, yeah, they're destructive. And you know, I always think of the phrase, there's a fox in the chicken house. That is born out of experience, right? But let me ask you this, what sorts of things need maintenance in a relationship? What sort of things are destructive to a good, solid foundation in a marriage or any close relationship? Name some things. Attitude is a big thing, right?
Disagreements.
Respect. And what?
Disagreements.
Okay.
Truthfulness.
Truthfulness, yeah.
Critical spirit.
Critical spirit. Mm-hmm.
Communication.
Communication. What do you say, Joe? Did you say something else?
Memories.
Okay.
Just like a pastor said this morning, we need to have short memories about a lot of
things. Oh, okay. I see what you mean. Yeah.
The herbs.
Right.
For decades, like the pastor said.
Right.
But we forget what God did for us yesterday.
Right, right. We need to keep a short list on what we remember that was bad, right? So I think what you're saying, and remember God. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great ideas there. Great ideas. And you think about that, you know, think about your own relationship. Could you have some foxes maybe in some of your relationships that kind of need shooing or catching and getting out of the way? You know, it's so sad. You know, you read in the paper. I don't read the paper very often, but when I do, and you see somebody in there that's been married for years and years and years, maybe in their 60s, and then they get a divorce, and you think, why did they get a divorce? Well, I think it's really because of zero preventative maintenance. What are some ways, what are some methods, okay, we've named some things that are problems, what are some methods we can employ to kind of work on some of these problems, some of these things that may need maintenance before they really break down and become even worse? What are some methods we might employ?
Well, you cannot stay angry or have a bad feeling or grudge against the person you pray for.
Yeah, pray for them. Yeah, that's a great method. It really is. Communication. Mm-hmm.
And they say never go to bed.
Yeah. It could be an upset stomach if you do. Right. Right. Good methods. Any others? Encouraging, right. That's good. That's important. All good things. I'm big on preventative maintenance myself as far as relationships go, and I believe the best preventative maintenance for relationships is really this, practicing agape love. I believe that is the best preventative maintenance we can practice to prevent a lot of other problems down the road, is practicing agape love. Now, love for Christians, as we all know, is commanded in the New Testament. If you didn't know that, you need to study it because it's in there. And here's one of the main places it's listed in John 15:12, where Jesus is speaking about really the whole church. And he says, this is my commandment, that you love one another just as I have loved you. And if that applies to the whole church, how much more should that apply to relationships that are supposed to be the most close and the most intimate relationships? Well, what is agape love, and how do we practice it? What is agape love, and how do we practice it?
Unconditional, depending on what the other person does.
Say that again, June. I'm sorry.
It doesn't depend on what the other person has done. It's unconditional.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it doesn't depend on what they've done, right. It's unconditional. Good point. Mm-hmm. Anybody else? I'm going to read two verses here that really explain it well. It goes right along with what June's saying here. Mark 12:29-31. And this is really in response. Jesus is going to respond to somebody who asked him, what commandment is foremost of all? Okay, and you probably know this verses. Jesus answered in Mark 12:29, the foremost commandment is, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, with all your mind and with all your strength. And the second is this, what?
Love your neighbor.
See, I knew you knew that verse. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And he says, there is no other commandment greater than these. And so, agape love is right here, in this verse right here, in verse 31, where it says, you should love your neighbor as yourself. What you do is you put yourself in their shoes, and you think about what would genuinely be the best thing for me if I was in a similar circumstance or situation that they're in, that my spouse is in, and then you do it. That's exactly what agape love is. It's putting yourself in their place, thinking about what would be best for them, and doing that. Also, over in Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 through 4, I know you know this verse as well, Paul's writing here and he says, do nothing from selfishness, and that's the opposite of agape love, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind regard one another as more important than yourselves.
Yeah, when you were talking about leading into this, that's the verse
that popped into your mind. The Holy Spirit is working in our midst here today, right? Popped into your mind as well. I'm going to read it again. Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, and it takes that, right? Regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. That is agape love right there. You know what? Christianity is just as radical today as it was in the first century. Because today, in our country today, what's the attitude? What's the concept of marriage? Well, it's all about me, right? What can I gain from this relationship? And if I don't like the other person after a few years, I'll just leave. If I don't get the same thrills as I had before, maybe, or I'll leave, or they change, and I'll just leave, or I'll change, or I'll find somebody else somehow. It's all about me. You know, what can I get from this thing? Christianity, on the other hand, what do? We take that concept and we turn it upside down, we turn it on its head, right? And we say instead, no, I'm going to put myself, as we read in Mark, in my spouse's shoes, think about what's best for them and do it. And I'm going to do what it says here in Philippians. I'm going to consider my spouse more important than myself and my own desires. I'm going to subordinate my own desires and my own wants to theirs. That's radical thinking today. If you go out there and you know, pastor's talking about encountering the culture, you'd go out and talk about that. That's radical in our day and time. That's countercultural to what the whole United States concept of marriage really is in a lot of cases anyhow. And this kind of comes into sharper focus, really, when we look at some examples of agape love. We won't spend a lot of time on it, but if you turn over to 1 Corinthians 13 for just a moment, if you have your Bible with you there. 1 Corinthians 13, I know you all know this is the chapter on love. It's the chapter on love. And really what we have here are examples of agape love. If you drop down to verse 4 is kind of where that part starts. Now, what's the first concept of love? What's the first example of love? Who's got chapter 4, verse 1? Patience, right? Patience. How can patience help in a relationship?
I wouldn't know.
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. Yeah, tell me about it, would you? You know, just think about that. Yeah, that's right. That's what I always say. You know, just think about it though. Preemptive, we're talking about preemptive maintenance. How many problems down the road could be solved today by this, by exercising patience, right? Exercising patience. What's the second one?
Kindness.
What does it mean to be kind? You know, what does it mean to be kind towards somebody?
Thoughtfulness.
Okay, yeah. That's basically it. Thoughtfulness. Being gracious, you know, kind of active goodwill towards someone. You practice something good for them. You do something good for them. You know, think about that. How preventative is that kind of behavior in a marriage or any close relationship? Just exercising kindness. You know, we a lot of times we'll do that out in the world and we get home and you know, things have changed. I'm at home now. I can relax, so to speak. And you forget that's the most important relationship. You need to exercise kindness. What's the next one? Does it really apply? What is the next one?
Envy.
Yeah, envy or jealousy. How does that apply? Does that apply? Does anybody ever, does that hurt a marriage, jealousy? Are you ever jealous of your spouse? Or can you be? Yeah, I think in certain situations. And you think about it, you can't really love somebody when you're jealous of them. How about bragging? That's the next one, or boasting. You know, what is boasting? What is boasting?
Building yourself up.
Yeah, building yourself up, putting yourself up here. You know, I'm up here. You know, if you live with somebody and they boast all the time like that, that could get pretty old. That could get pretty old, I would think. But, yeah, right. Yeah, and you get some experience by working with some of them. It's really the exact opposite of agape love, you know, putting yourself up first, bragging, preeminent, so on. And then arrogance, it talks about arrogance. Love is, let's see, where are we here? Is not arrogant, right? You know, putting yourself as maybe better than your spouse, your partner. Acting unbecomingly, it says in my translation. Love does not act unbecomingly. And I had to kind of look that up and study a little bit because of what it really means is just to have poor manners.
Not rude,
great. Yeah, not rude. That's better than my translation, I think. Not rude, right. Having poor manners. And again, it gets back to, you know, you go to work and maybe you're out in the world doing something and you're so nice to everybody and you have good manners. You open the doors for the ladies and you say, yes, please, and so on and so forth. You get home and everything changes. It shouldn't be that way. Really, when you think about it, this is preemptive maintenance. And how many problems could be solved if we were just more polite, simple politeness towards each other. It's important. It really is. Just a couple more here. And this is one that kind of Joe brought up a minute ago, not provoked. Or actually, the next one's even better, but is not provoked. You know, don't let anger get the better of you. And then it says, don't take into account a wrong suffered. Okay, that's what we were talking about. Love does not take into account a wrong suffered. And what that really means, that a Greek word actually talks about, is keeping a list of something. You know, I'm big on lists myself. I like to make lists and then never do them. But a record, that's even better, a record of wrongs, right? And that's exactly what it's talking about. So getting back to what you mentioned a few minutes ago, don't keep that list. Jettison those hurts as best you can out of your mind, out of your heart. Don't keep a list in your head so you can clobber your spouse later on with it. You know, and just, this is all about preventative maintenance. What's that? Yes. Sure. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. And also you get to know your spouse's heart a little more.
Yeah.
Than you normally do.
Yeah. I agree, June.
I think it's very important.
I think it is. It just does something in your relationship. You can't even put your finger on it really, but it really kind of enlivens it a little bit. Seems to bring more strength to your relationship somehow. Good thing to bring up. These are all really great examples of agape love. And I got to say, in our class, we've got some rock stars in our class, I believe, who are really good examples of this radical agape love in marriage. People who in our class and in our church who are willing to give of themselves for the betterment of their spouses. They're right among us. But, you know, think about it, especially if you are having issues in your marriage. Could it be that your marriage's foundation could be so much better simply by this preventative maintenance? You know,
okay.
Yeah. Right. Right. That's a great part too. You know, it bears everything for them. It believes all things, believes good things about them. And their hopes are best for their spouse, endures all things. Yeah. Those are all great things. And, you know, you think about it, how many things could be solved, how many problems a couple might be facing right now in their marriage may actually be dissolved, those problems dissolved, simply by practicing agape love towards each other. A company I used to work for 21 years, we had five owners over 21 years, and each time a new owner would come in, we get to experience their new IT department. Experience it. Sometimes we'd be talking to somebody halfway around the world in India or who knows where, China. Sometimes we'd be talking to people in the United States. But one thing I found out over the years is that they'll go through these little, let's say you're not getting your emails or you're only getting some of your emails. They'll go through and do all this diagnostic stuff and you're on the phone with them, listening to them. And then at the end, if it isn't working, they'll say, well, why don't you just try to reboot your computer? And you do it, and you know what? 80 to 90% of the time takes care of the problem. So I learned to just do that first before calling IT. But the point I bring that up is marriage is a lot like that. I believe that what this preventative maintenance really is, it's kind of like a reboot on your computer. You can solve a lot of problems in your relationships by just practicing this agape love towards each other, putting the other up on a pedestal more important than yourself, sort of thing, in your mind, in your attitude.
Make sure you're plugged in.
Plugged in?
To each other.
No, okay. I thought you meant a computer.
Well,
plugged in to each other.
Question, is it plugged in?
Yeah. That's another question they'd ask. Plugged in. And you need to be plugged in to what's going on in their lives, their personal lives. And that's why it's so important to pray together and talk together at the end of the day. That's really the first building block. The other two don't take as much time, but the second building block, really for a solid foundation of a relationship, is to build trust. To build trust. If who has 2:16 of Solomon, Song of Solomon open that would like to read it? 2:16. It's an easy one. Anybody? Okay. Thanks. Thanks. All right. 2:16. First of all, this is the Shulamite woman, and obviously she says, my beloved is mine, and I am his. My beloved is mine, and I am his." You know, it's her speaking, and you think about that. What a beautiful statement, really, of the dedicated love that they shared toward one another. My beloved is mine, and my beloved is mine, and I am his. It reminds me of Ruth, where she says, you know, to her mother-in-law, she kind of dedicates herself to her mother-in-law, and she says, "Where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge, and your God will be my God, and your people will be my people." It's kind of that dedication and just that dedicated love. And then this Shulamite woman talks about how her husband-to-be, what does it say, feeds or pastures his flock among the lilies. What's she talking about here, do you suppose? Anybody?
He smells good.
Huh? He smells good. She likes his cologne. It smells like lilies. Well, here's something. Go back to the first part of the chapter, chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. And it kind of gives us a little bit of a clue, I think, here, maybe. It says in chapter 2, verse 1, she's speaking again. She says, I'm the rose of Sharon, the lily of the valleys. She's talking about herself. I'm the lily of the valleys. And then verse 2, like a lily among the thorns, so is my darling among the maidens. And that's Solomon speaking. He calls her a lily. I believe in verse 16, what she's talking about here is that how her husband-to-be feeds among or pastures his flock among, he's around other women, is what I'm trying to say.
Browses.
That's interesting. Browses? I've never seen that translation. Browsing among the women. Wow.
Doesn't sound good.
You don't want to browse if you're betrothed to somebody. But, and that kind of adds credence to what I believe here. It's almost as if she's kind of repeating to herself over and over to reassure herself of the fact that, you know, he belongs to me, she says, and no other lilies, and she belongs to him. And, you know, even beyond that, though, when you look at this verse in verse 16, just notice the level of trust that these words imply.
I think fidelity also applies here, too.
Fidelity, yes, definitely. Trust, fidelity. Right, exactly. Mm-hmm.
My footnotes say that they belong to each other exclusively.
Exclusively, right. That's that trust. You start to say something?
Well, I think maybe this, he browses among the lilies. I think she's saying that he chose me.
Yeah. Yeah, she kind of, she can hardly believe maybe that, yeah. Or whatever, that he chose her.
He had a choice of everybody and he chose
right. Out of all the hundreds that he could have had. I mean, he is at this point either going to be the king or is the king at this point. Not sure, but definitely, yeah, he chose her. Right. There's a lot of trust there, isn't there? You know, he's out among, he routinely moves around all these other women and they probably smell good and doesn't really browse. He moves among them. He lives among them, let's put it that way. But the point is really here, I think, that she trusts him. She trusts his, as you said, fidelity. Trust, really. Trust is really an essential element, isn't it? Of a strong foundation in marriage and a relationship, especially in a marriage relationship. And in verse 16, the bride expresses her trust in her husband even when they're apart. Let's talk about trust for just a minute. Let me ask you a question. Is trust automatic? Anybody think it is? I doubt it. Trust has to be developed, doesn't it? Really has to be developed. Really takes some time sometimes. And it really is developed by repetition. And it's really the same way in marriage. You know, trust is developed over time by repetitive experience. I was raised a Roman Catholic, as I've talked about in here before, but when we did what we called our first communion, they gave us this little communion packet. And it had a little rosary in it, I think, and a little Bible with some of the verses and some other little things in there, and maybe a bookmark or something, I don't remember now. And then when we got to be what they call, when you got to be 12 years old, you had confirmation, and then they give you a confirmation packet. Well, in our diocese, when somebody got married, they'd give him a little marriage packet. And I don't know what was in there because when we got married, I wasn't a Catholic anymore. I was saved. But, living in Tulsa. But they give him this little marriage packet. And, the thing is, and probably today it's just a little plug into your computer. It's a little fob you can plug into your computer. They probably don't give a packet. But the thing is, not one of those packets ever came complete with downloads of trust. You can't just download trust and have trust just like that. You know, trust in marriage has to be developed by experience. You ever did that? Have you ever done that exercise of falling backwards into somebody's arms? You know, I'll pick Jerry. He's a pretty good son. There he is. Stand behind me and I'll fall and he'd catch me because he's pretty good strong. He could do that. I've done, I think I did that once, some kind of trust building thing we did at work one time maybe, but it's kind of hard at first if you've ever done it. It was for me. I wasn't sure. I think the guy that was going to catch me wasn't any bigger than I was. And I thought, I don't know if this dude can handle it. But he did. You know, the second time, it was a little easier, but not much. You know, the third time, I didn't do it the third time, but I can imagine the third and fourth time, you know, you probably get a little better at it. And it's the same way really in marriage. You know, trust is developed over time by repetition. So if that's true, let me ask you, what are some practical things couples can do to develop that trust?
Never lie.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you lie a little bit or a lot, it's going to damage the trust you have in a relationship. You can't really trust someone if they don't tell you the truth, right? What else?
Communicate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'll develop trust just by telling your spouse honestly what's on your mind, right? What else? Oh, okay. Yeah. Right.
That way you know that
walk the walk.
Pretty much every aspect
mm-hmm.
of their human relationship.
Yeah, yeah, you would. You'd think it'd be consistent, wouldn't you? Mm-hmm. Good point. Walk the walk that you've talked. Anything else? Developing that trust.
Keeping your word.
One thing I think we can do, we've already really talked about it, and that is practicing agape love with your spouse. Over in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25, it says, "Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her." You go down to verse 28. "So husbands ought also to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it." Don't you nourish? You're getting ready to here in a few minutes. Nourish and cherish your flesh. "Just as Christ also does the church." The point is here, of course, this is a great snapshot right here of agape love and marriage, of just the husband is supposed to nourish, cherish your wife, you know, cherish that relationship. And so as we practice agape love, our spouses see that we have their best interests at heart over time. That builds trust. It builds trust. And the other method I wanted to mention just in passing is that trust, I think, can be developed or added to the foundation of a marriage by simply fulfilling the roles that God has given us. Fulfilling the roles that God has given us. The husband's role, basically, and you know this from studying the Bible, is to lead. And the wife's role, I'm not going to tell you. What is it? I don't want to get in trouble. Now, as you know, it's to submit, as it says in the Bible. And the reason I say that, you know, I thought of the pastor this morning when he said, you know, if somebody doesn't like something he says, he points to the Bible and says, well, show me where it's wrong. Don't get mad at me. Get mad at God. It's kind of the same thing here. This is not popular in our culture, this teaching that husbands are to lead and the wife's role is to submit not in a servile kind of way, like some kind of slave, but in sort of a loving and agreeable type way. Since we're in Ephesians, I'm in Ephesians right now, chapter 5, verse 22, "Wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife." Now that's talking about the leadership, right? "The husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also wives ought to be to their husbands in everything." And then over in Colossians chapter 3, as soon as I get over there, chapter 3, what is it? Oh, yeah, 18 and 19. "Wives, be subject to your husbands as is fitting in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and do not be embittered against them." There's a little agape love clues there. Over in 1 Peter 3, verse 1. "In the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives." This is talking about, you know, Chloe was talking about how the fact that women seem to come to Christ easier in the Middle East. Well, this verse right here is talking about how a woman, when she becomes saved, can actually, by her behavior, draw her husband to Christ. where it says, in the same way, wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives. You drop down to verse 7 and talks about the husbands. You husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way. That word understanding actually means intimate, an intimate way. And it's talking about feelings and things, you know. As Judy mentioned, you know, I think it was her talking about being connected with them. Live with your wives in a connected way as with someone weaker, since she is a woman, and show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered. Okay? So husband's role is to honor, to cherish, to lead. Wives, agreeably submitting to the husband's leadership. Now, how would simply fulfilling our God-given roles build trust in a marriage, or would it? What do you think? You ever think about that? I really didn't until I studied this lesson, but it came to me.
Well, Michael has used the analogy of a military unit.
Uh-huh.
There are levels of leadership and responsibility. Mm-hmm. You must respect the one above it.
Mm-hmm.
In order for the whole unit to work well.
Yeah.
When you get into a position in a skirmish or whatever it is you're trained to do, that training takes over. And as a result, you have trust in the people that you work with, and you know they've got your back, and it just works better.
Yeah. It works. The whole unit works better. The whole marriage works better. Right. It works better. And building trust. But just think about it. You know, guys, have you ever thought about how much trust it really takes? How much trust your wife has to exercise each time she follows your lead? Have you ever thought about that? She's really got to exercise trust. And when every time you try to lead, she has to trust you that what you've decided is best really is best. And that's the way trust is developed, is by exercise. She has to trust, and over time, she becomes more trusting. And ladies, have you ever thought about how much trust your husband really has to exercise in you? And every time he tries to lead, he's got to really trust that you are actually going to follow what he thinks is best. I mean, if it can actually shake your confidence if you don't think people are going to follow your lead. What I'm saying is that as we repetitively lead as husbands, and as we repetitively follow as wives, over time, a real trust is developed in each other. And so that's the second point. And we're kind of out of time here. But yeah, Joe, why don't you?
Just one comment.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. You use the Ephesians 5 text about wives and men. Uh-huh. Before that, husbands, and here's the level.
Uh-huh.
Husbands, love your wives.
Uh-huh. Right.
Everything he gave himself for us, for the church. Everything he did was for the origin, the build-up, and the salvation of the church.
Exactly.
So a wife will trust her husband as she sees her husband trusting Christ.
Yes, that's true.
And if you trust Christ, she sees that, and all of us need to be better at it. I'm not saying
right.
All of us need to be better at that.
Sure.
As we trust Christ, then our wives can have better trust that what we're saying, where we're leading, what we're doing.
Right. That's a good point. That's a great point, because our wives know that Christ is perfect. And if we're following Christ, we're going the right way. And if she sees us following Christ, I think is what you're saying, is she's going to have more trust in us. That's a good, great point.
It's almost like, be you followers of me, even as I am of Christ. Well, to our wives, you can follow me as your husband because I'm following Christ.
Yeah. Right. That whole passage in Ephesians there is talking about how a marriage actually is supposed to exemplify the church or represent the church. And it's supposed to be sort of a little microcosm of the church, a marriage is. We don't really have time to go over the last part of this, darn it. Chapter 3, verses 1 through 5, the more romantic part, but it's talking about restraint. And it's really describing a dream that this Shuhamite woman has. And in her dream, she's restless because she can't find in her dream anyway the soul whom, or rather the one whom my soul loves, she says. And in her dream, she's all alone. She misses him. She goes out in search of him. And in this dream, in the nighttime, she's all alone, and she runs into these guards there in the city. But she's searching for him, and eventually she finds him in her dream. But if you go to the end of that in verse 4 and 5, or actually verse 4, you can kind of see how she practices restraint in verse 4. I'll just read that here. In her dreams come to, still in her dream, she says, "Scarcely had I left them when I found him whom my soul loves. I held on to him and would not let him go until I had brought him to my mother's house, into the room of her who conceived me." So she's actually practicing restraint here. She doesn't take him to her bedroom. She just does the opposite here. She takes him to her parents' house, right into the room where her mom was at. You know, when I was dating in high school, I always remember how when I went over to my girlfriend's house, her mom and dad would always have us stay out in the open. I didn't like that. I didn't understand that back then. I understand it now. But I know why they did that. So the fact is, in taking him to her parents' house, she's really showing her determination to practice restraint. And she expounds that in verse 5 to the other girls in Jerusalem. But she tells them to be wise. She tells them not to allow one's passions to get out of control until the appropriate time, which is after the marriage. You know, and you look at this, unless you're dating somebody right now, this may have very little application, but think about our grandkids and kids. You know, we're living in a culture that is just absolutely the opposite of what we're reading about here of being restrained. And so what can we do for our grandkids and kids who live among those who don't know God, those who, have just the opposite, worldview of practicing restraint? Is there something we can do? You know, think about that. I don't expect you to turn in a term paper, but just think about it. Is there some practical things we can do?
Pray.
Pray is great.
That's a great example.
Being a great example. Kind of gets back to what Joe mentioned a minute ago, is the fact that, yeah, that example has such an impact in our culture.
Uh-huh. 15 years and all that. But take her out once a week.
Yeah.
She needed to know how a young man should act around her and to her.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's good.
As a result, he could give her that instruction
so that
she would have some kind of frame of reference.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's great. Just keep in touch with your kids that way, too, and you know what they're thinking about. Maybe they're more open to you when you do that. Well, those were the three that we wanted to mention this week, you know, building a strong foundation by preventative maintenance, by building trust, and then, of course, practicing restraint. Well, I don't want to keep you any longer because I know you want to cherish and nourish your bodies now after being in church for a few hours. So don't cherish it too much or nourish it too much. I'll go ahead and pray and we'll, I guess, be dismissed. Heavenly Father, we thank you for today. We thank you that you gave us a book written by Solomon so many years ago that has absolute application for our lives today in marriage. Lord, help us not to just pass over this book briefly, but help us to study it, help us to read it, help us make application in our relationships we have today, especially in our marriage relationships today, because it is just as applicable today as it was 2,500 years ago. And we ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.